you've got the potential for failure, even if you got to the next step beyond where they went.
Did the United States miss an opportunity to reach out to North Korea? It's Thursday, February 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Maldives' political crisis deepens. Racially charged politics in Australia. Celebrating Lunar New Year in the United States. A brutal female tradition challenged. Tech startups. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United States has acknowledged that Vice President Mike Pence was to meet North Korean officials on the sidelines of the Winter Olympics February 10th, but it was scrapped by the North just 2 hours before, following Pence's criticism of its rights record. The vice president was going to meet the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and the nominal head of state Kim Yong-nam. On Tuesday, a Pence spokesman characterized the office as the North dangling a meeting in exchange for a softened message. He said had the meeting taken place, the vice president would have delivered an uncompromising message that the North must denuclearize, that the United States would not change its position or negotiate. Bruce Bennett is a senior international defense researcher at the RAND Corporation. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty such a prospect is surprising given North Korean pre-Olympic statements no such meeting would take place, and he described how they prefer to enter such talks.
For the North Koreans, you negotiate from a position of strength. You try to say that the other side is negotiating with you because they're giving in to you. And so when Vice President Pence does quite the opposite and is critical of North Korea's human rights record, there is no way in their culture that they can proceed with any kind of negotiation or even really political interaction.
A Pence spokesman said the decision was made that if such talks took place, the U.S. would deliver an uncompromising message about denuclearization. What actually could have been covered in such a meeting?
The key there is the United States telling North Korea that, look, we're still serious about denuclearization, but North Korea is consistently saying that they're never going to happen. So you've got the potential for failure, even if you got to the next step beyond where they went. If they'd even sat down together, they would have been talking past each other, the U.S. wanting to talk denuclearization and the North representatives refusing to do so. So it was pretty clear that for all the hype, there really wasn't much of an opportunity here.
Bruce Bennett said while it appears the North wasn't prepared to compromise, they also earlier indicate no talks would be considered. For Go Myung-hyun, research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies, this was a missed opportunity.
I definitely think so. I definitely think the South Korean government was very much open about its desire for the United States and North Korea to sit down together for the occasion of the Olympics and talk about denuclearization. Because I think there's some sense in the South Korean government that there's a very small window opportunity right now to stabilize the situation in the Korean Peninsula after the Olympics. We know that the U.S. and South Korea agreed to postpone the joint military exercise because of the Olympics. But then the joint military exercise, which is very much opposed by North Korea, is going to resume right after the Olympics. So I think the South Korean government wanted to somehow create this climate where there will be pretty much detente between DPRK and then Washington, even after the Olympics. And for that reason alone, the meeting between the high-level officials from both sides was very much a requirement for that desire to be fulfilled. And they didn't, and they basically failed. So I think there's a palpable disappointment on the part of South Korea right now.
Go Myung-hyun said while both South Korea and the United States have indicated they are prepared to launch joint military exercises postponed until after the Olympics, the South may consider modifying them as a sign of its desire to keep alive the thaw in the peninsula tensions. Meanwhile, the U.S. cybersecurity firm FireEye said a North Korean cyber espionage group it calls APT-37, or Advanced Persistent Threat, which has hacked South Korean government and private sector targets, has expanded its attacks to Japan, Vietnam, and the Middle East in 2017. Its focus is gathering intelligence, not destruction or financial theft. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Indonesia quietly passes law to quash criticism of politicians. Political calculations led Vatican to agree with China on bishop appointment, according to analysts. South Korea official says General Motors offers $2.8 billion investment in South Korea over 10 years. Pakistan's Sharif declared ineligible to head his party. Bollywood menstruation movie sparks controversy over a taboo subject. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia and also on our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The president of the Indian Ocean Archipelago of the Maldives, Abdullah Yameen, is seeking a 30-day extension of his state of emergency, first declared February 5th and to last for 15 days. But with an opposition boycott, he's been unable to muster the minimum 43 votes in parliament for a quorum. The declaration was made so Mr. Yameen could annul a Supreme Court ruling reversing the convictions of 9 opposition leaders and ordering their release. His administration arrested 2 court justices, including the Chief Justice, other opposition leaders, and even a former president, Mamoun Abdul Gayoom, charging them with trying to overthrow the government. David Brewster is a visiting fellow in strategic and defense studies at the Australian National University. He tells VOA he has little doubt the president will extend the state of emergency until the opposition is quashed in what he insists is a constitutional crisis.
Well, if there's a constitutional crisis, it was a crisis of his making by ignoring the rulings of the Supreme Court, essentially sacking the Supreme Court and arresting opposition leaders. So one could expect that they will continue to fight until there is at least some indication that he's willing to discuss a settlement or some other resolution of the problem. If there's a crisis, it's his crisis.
China, India, Britain, and the United States have all issued warnings against travel to the Indian Ocean island chain, which has luxury hotels, scuba diving, and tropical seas. David Brewster says the Maldives' tourism economy has been impacted amid hundreds of bookings canceled, and while India has intervened before, he tells VOA the current situation presents difficulties for New Delhi.
I have previously said they are in a very difficult position. They continue to be in a very difficult position. They would certainly like to get rid of Yameen. It's not clear that they have a pathway to do that. Last week, they instituted unscheduled naval and air exercises off the west coast of India as a warning to Yameen to negotiate. In the last 48 hours, the Chinese Navy has also entered into the Indian Ocean, although they seem to be a long way from the Maldives at the moment. But clearly, China is now an important factor in the crisis. China last week publicly warned India against any intervention in the crisis, military or otherwise, and I think it will be taking actions to show its support for Yameen and to back up its warnings against India.
China enjoys a close economic relationship with Mr. Yameen and, long range, would like to establish security ties or even a security presence in the Maldives. Happening now in Asia, North Korean officials canceled secret Olympics meetings with the United States Vice President. The White House says the abrupt move is a sign that U.S. attempts to exert pressure on the regime are working in efforts to bring denuclearization to the Korean Peninsula. You can follow more online at VOA60. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's Thursday morning. We're glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Politicians in Australia are being accused of racist mischief-making over reports of gangs of young African migrants and refugees running amok in Melbourne. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said the situation was out of control. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports community leaders accused him of making inflammatory and inaccurate statements for political gain.
Fights and violent robberies involving young African migrants have prompted a stern response from Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull.
We are very concerned at the growing gang violence in Victoria, in particular in Melbourne.
In the state of Victoria, the Acting Assistant Police Commissioner Shane Patton said he was worried about escalating rates of crime.
Over December, we've seen a number of separate incidents which have cumulatively given rise to this whole issue of African youth offending. We've had an assault of a police member then occur on Boxing Day in High Point. That was a horrendous assault, to be kicked in the face whilst arresting someone and then to have a group of African youths gather around them.
Jason Wood, a federal MP in Melbourne and a former police officer, says his constituency has been racked by gang violence.
In some suburbs, I know in Clyde and Clyde North, there's been aggravated burglaries in 1 in 20 homes, which is quite incredible when you think about it. I've had families where African gangs, and we believe it'll be the Sudanese, have come back 2 or 3 times and terrorised the one family. The first occasion, they kicked the door in at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Official statistics show that 1% of all offenders in Victoria last year were Sudanese-born. This migrant community makes up just 0.01% of the state's total population. And while the Sudanese are overrepresented in the crime figures, the number of offences is small. Zioni Walker and Fender from the African Australian Communities Leadership Forum believe some politicians and the tabloid press are exaggerating the problem of so-called gang violence by young migrants.
We should not be distracted by name-calling, political point scoring, or media sensationalism in trying to sell stories. We finally ask the media to demonstrate more responsible reporting on these difficult issues affecting our community and balance their reporting with the many positive stories that are happening within the African Australian community. A majority of African Australians have great stories to tell about their lives, about the positive contributions they make to Australia.
Stay on your toes. Blur. You're staying flat foot, so you have to stay on your toes.
At a gym in Sydney, a basketball club run by a former Sudanese refugee, Mayo Chagai, is helping young Africans stay on the right side of the law.
What happened in Melbourne is not something new, because when I first came to Sydney here in 2006, I straight away heard about horrible thing about us, about migrant being called parasites, sucking the social services, and being called lazy and being called criminals.
15-year-old Sudanese refugee Moniping says he and his friends are also wrongly accused of being troublemakers.
You see in the media, it says that, oh, Sudanese boys are doing bad stuff in Melbourne, robbing people, and then they think every Sudanese boy is the same around here. If you do something small, they make it look like, oh, something big. And then we go to the shopping centres and all that, they make it sound like, oh, we're going to steal and all that stuff, but we're not even going to steal, we're just going to buy stuff and leave, that's it.
The Sudanese aren't the only group of migrants to have found life tough in Australia. It can take generations to feel accepted. Just ask the Greeks, the Italians, and the Vietnamese. They all endured hardships and discrimination when they first arrived, but are now well-established parts of a multicultural country. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Malaysian police have arrested 10 suspected Islamic militants who are trying to establish a foothold on the island of Borneo. They are suspected of aiding the movement of militants between the eastern state of Sabah and the southern Philippines, a hotbed of Islamic insurgency. A hot place to visit every day is VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, many Asian countries are now celebrating the Lunar New Year, also known as the Spring Festival, in China, and also called the Chinese New Year by many people. It's a multinational holiday in many Asian countries, and it lasts about 2 weeks. But how is this festival celebrated in the United States? VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles, a city with one of the largest Asian communities in the U.S.
People are flocking to Chinatown in the heart of Los Angeles to experience the sights and sounds of the new year and welcoming in the year of the dog.
It's very important for us to celebrate Chinese New Year because of our Chinese heritage.
In its 119th year, this Golden Dragon Parade has become a Lunar New Year tradition for many people, including Henry Hua, who has been watching this parade since 1980. But this is not his only tradition of the season.
We would decorate our house with flowers, lights. We would do all that to give it a festive New Year's feeling, and then loved ones will celebrate with us and give red envelopes. At night, we would gather together.
In Hong Kong, we have relatives. In L.A., we have friends. So it's a lot of more culture, different type of people celebrating Chinese New Year.
Different types of people, all with an appreciation for Chinese culture. Wishing everyone a happy and prosperous New Year in Mandarin, Avery Schott learned his Mandarin in school.
It's just about bringing the family together and, you know, honoring the Chinese culture and just keeping the tradition and keeping that culture alive so that the little ones can enjoy it and many generations to come can enjoy it.
A view echoed by authorities about these celebrations.
We're bringing together everybody from everywhere in the world right here in Los Angeles.
Happy New Year!
I think there are a few places in the world that could be able to pull this off. To be able to bring 100,000 people together in celebration of this culture says an awful lot.
For many families attending this parade, the hope is that their children will gain an appreciation for the annual cultural festival and continue the tradition in decades to come. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This news from VOA Asia. Japanese officials say its military has witnessed a cargo transfer between China and North Korea on the high seas, and it suspects violates the United Nations economic sanctions on Pyongyang, those in response to North Korea's persistent nuclear and missile test activities. You're free to share all the stories we post on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, female circumcision is a common but brutal practice in some cultures where it affects millions of women in 30 countries, including parts of Asia and mostly in Africa. The results are painful and sometimes life-threatening. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, one hospital in a remote desert region of Ethiopia is working to help some of them.
In this village in the Afar region of Ethiopia, the traditional but atrocious practice of female genital mutilation is common. This woman does not want to be shown on camera, but 25-year-old Khadija does want people to know she was only 7 days old when she was forced to endure genital mutilation.
Because I was cut when I was 7 days old, I was unable to hold my urine for long, and when I must go, I have to endure an excruciating burning sensation. Later, when my menstruation began, the pain worsened even more. And after I got married, it was painful to have sexual intercourse with my husband.
She was married at 14, and a year later went through the difficult birth of her first child. After having two more children, she experienced renal complications that almost resulted in her death. Her situation, unfortunately, is not unusual. According to an Ethiopian health survey in 2016, three-quarters of Ethiopian females have had genital circumcision. And in the Afar region, 9 out of 10 females have been subjected to the practice, most before they were even a year old. A doctor at a hospital in Afar says it is hard to change the attitudes of families toward female circumcision because it is the cultural norm. But he says he can make it easier for women to deliver their babies.
We perform a deinfibulation procedure in which we make an incision in their vagina to recover the appropriate opening that the mutilation removed.
Other women come to the hospital to find a way to relieve the painful results of their circumcision.
Most of them are also very stressed emotionally. After receiving our pain-free de-infibulation services, they go back home feeling happy. Most of them vow to never let another woman go through female genital mutilation.
This woman, now a midwife, used to perform circumcisions.
When I used to cut girls' genitals using this blade, I always made sure it was very sharp, like this. Otherwise, the girls could go through severe physical pain.
She used to believe that her work safeguarded a woman's virginity and marital faithfulness.
That was my justification for doing it. But after attending trainings, especially by religious leaders and government, I now understand this practice is wrong and it can destroy a child's future.
Ethiopia's government is tackling the issue through public health services, but Khadija is determined to stop the practice now.
Whenever I find a parent that still insists on practicing female genital mutilation, I try to convince them otherwise. Their small girls shouldn't go through what I went through and live a similar gruesome life like mine.
The United Nations reports at least 200 million women worldwide have undergone some form of female genital mutilation. 44 million of them are 14 years old or younger. Deborah Block, VOA News.
5 years ago, Israeli investor John Medved started Our Crowd. It's a business that lets people buy into some of the newest and most innovative tech startups in the world. Some of the most innovative new products were on display at the recent Investor Summit. VOA's Faith Lapidus narrates this report by Kevin Enix.
John Medved is the man behind Our Crowd, an investment platform that lets people buy into tech startups.
Because today, everybody wants to invest in a startup. You look at your, stock portfolio, you look at, interest rates. You want to get something which will really, be non-correlated, which will give you a very, very big bang for your buck. And everybody wants to do startups, but how do you do it?
One of the most promising tech sectors is the place where technology and the health industry intersect.
So what's starting to happen now is the convergence of digital health, artificial intelligence, and all of the high technologies that have been previously used for computer industry are now being brought to bear in the healthcare industry. And it's impacting not only the diagnosis of patients, but actually how to treat people as well. And that's a huge revolution.
This is the MEMIC, a new tool for robotic surgery.
MEMIC is founded by Dvir Cohen, who actually spent his years in the military developing snake drones. So drones are able to get into buildings that look like snakes. And he took that technology and he did something amazing with it. He created a laparoscopic surgery device that is specifically designed primarily for gynecological surgery. So you can actually use these arms now to do gynecological surgery.
Another growing sector is technology that's being used to fight global warming and save money.
We build an entire system which sucks in air from the building, cleans it using these materials, and puts it right back into the building's circulation. So these materials therefore enable the cleaning of the air, which therefore translates into better indoor air quality, and of course the economic benefit.
Another Our Crowd winner is the Airbotics drone, a fully automated drone that investors here are convinced is the future of unmanned flying technology. For writer Kevin Enox, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us in many places like iTunes and SoundCloud. And we invite you to stream our program from our VOA Asia Facebook page and also our website at voanews.com. If you happen to miss part or any of our episodes, they're all there on the website. Just go and find us at VOA Asia. We'd also love to hear from you. You can write to us either through VOA Asia Facebook or send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We can also be heard on the radio through much of Asia, including Singapore, Media Biz Radio at Temasek Polytechnic. Thanks for carrying our program and everyone there who is listening today. Our thanks, too, go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Jonah Cummings, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.